So, first of all, thank you so much to Tom DiLorenzo and Lou Rockwell, especially, for having me here today. It's my first time at the Mises Institute. I'm very excited to be here. And as Tom mentioned, I'm the director of the Libertarian Institute. And as such, I have to admit that I have Institute envy pretty bad here today. Mark Thornton gave me the big tour this morning. This is the most impressive institution in the world. It's my dream that the Libertarian Institute could ever be anything like a rival or a peer to the Mises Institute. It's really great and has, of course, been probably the most important libertarian institution as long as I've been interested in the subject, which would be going back to at least the 1990s. But I do have some news. It's not exactly to rival the Ludwig von Mises Institute, but I do have a new project. It's I've put together with the help of a friend of mine, Tom Woods. You guys might have heard of him. And Tom Woods has built me my own Liberty classroom. It's called the Scott Horton Academy of Foreign Policy and Freedom. And it'll be debuting next month. And so it's going to be two big courses by me on the war on terrorism and the Cold War with Russia. It's going to be Jim Bovard on 40 years of investigative journalism, Ramzi Baroud on Israel-Palestine, Richard Booth on the true story behind the Oklahoma City bombing, William Buppert on how America lost every war since 1945, and the great C.J. Kilmer as well on how Woodrow Wilson is the worst human who ever existed. So the website is scotthortonacademy.com. You can start entering your email addresses now and get ready for that. It's coming very soon. And huge thank you to Tom Woods for that. All right, now, anti-imperialism, of course, is an essential part of the libertarian movement and the political philosophy of libertarianism. Of course, Murray Rothbard wrote that war is the key to the whole libertarian business. Well, that's how we pronounce it where I'm from. And of course, that's true because you can't have a world empire and a limited government at home, never mind, you know, anarcho-capitalism and the Ancapistan we all dream of. But how could you have anything like a limited government at home when you have a world empire abroad and, in fact, the most dominant world empire in all of history? As my colleague at the Libertarian Institute, Keith Knight, wrote, it requires a state of domestic imperialism here at home for the government to keep us all in line enough, if for nothing else, to raise the revenue and the armies to wage their world empire. We might find, if we abandon the empire, that we don't really need Washington, D.C. that much at all. We could start to abolish all of these major departments and agencies and roll all these authorities back to the states and to the people, like the Bill of Rights says. And so, of course, anti-imperialism is at the heart of libertarianism. It has to be. How could we possibly have a limited government with a world empire? Now, in 1969, there was famously, and through 1970, there's the famous break in the Young Americans for Freedom, where the libertarians at the big convention in St. Louis in 69 walked out over Vietnam. So we are not going to support this. And then by 1971, some of the refugees from Young Americans for Freedom had created the Libertarian Party, and with anti-imperialism at the core of its platform. Of course, as it had to be. And as I'm sure everyone in this room knows, very famously and importantly, Murray Rothbard in 1978 published the Libertarian Manifesto. And included in there is Chapter 11, War and Foreign Policy, where he breaks down a full revisionist take on the old Cold War with the Soviet Union, when at least back then they still were a gigantic communist empire. But he went and explained from the free market point of view why we need not have this Cold War even with the Soviet communists. Of course, you know, in later times, in the 1990s, it was the libertarians who led the opposition to the wars in the Balkans, and which were so complicated and so few even understood. but the libertarians did. They cared a lot about it, and they opposed intervention there in Bosnia-Herzegovina and later in the Kosovo War. And it was during the Kosovo War that antiwar.com really grew into its own. They'd been created by Eric Garris, founded the site at the end of 1995. And they had done, you know, some coverage, but it was really in the Kosovo War of 1999 where they came into their own. And this is when I first found antiwar.com. I still remember to this day my friend Shauna showing me, hey, look at this site. And it was Christmas time because I remember there were like Christmas decorations around. I guess it must have been late 98 before the Balkan War had actually started. And she said, look at this. And it has a big red logo at the top, antiwar.com. And I still remember, I said to her, oh, what is this, some kind of socialist thing? And she goes, no, look, look. And she pages down. Look, they run Ron Paul. I go, no, no way. Because I've been a Ron Paul guy since 97. So, all right, they run Ron Paul at antiwar.com. And then she goes, and look, click, click, and a couple clicks through. And this actually wasn't on antiwar.com, but it was a couple clicks through led to Lincoln, the American Lenin, by L. Neil Smith. And I went, wow, they're not just libertarians, but they're right-wing, anti-government, hardcore libertarians. And they own the URL, antiwar.com. Oh my God, that's so important. And I didn't catch on to reading Raimondo then. I didn't really have the internet regularly for another couple of years. But it was so important to me to know that there are free market capitalists who own that URL, were holding down that website and that work. And then, of course, so speaking of Justin Raimondo was the founding editorial director of antiwar.com and, of course, Murray Rothbard's heir on foreign policy. I know from Eric Garris that there's a lot of Rothbard on foreign policy that was actually written by Justin, and there's a lot of Justin on foreign policy that was actually written by Murray Rothbard, because they would cover for each other a lot back in those days. And then he was my mentor, and my job was filling Justin's articles with all those links all those years. So I accept responsibility. Sorry about that, and also you're welcome. I know it was a bit of overkill. I kind of can't help myself. And antiwar.com is still going strong, and we have a whole new generation of guys at the site as well. And of course, our foreign policy in America is still horrible enough that we need it. So antiwar.com is still there. And now, I gotta say, even the regime libertarians in Washington, D.C. have been pretty good on foreign policy. They haven't been the best, and there's been plenty to fight about, and many of them got Iraq War II wrong. But then they all had to eat their hat and say that they were sorry. People like Brick Lindsey at Reason Magazine and some others, they had to admit that that was completely crazy to say that America has to overthrow the whole world and make it all free before we can have freedom in our own country. That's insane. And it proved to, of course, not be anything like true. We've all lost our freedom as our government has waged this world empire. So there were a few, but most of them apologized. But recently, just since the Ukraine-Russia war started, we've had some backsliding among the regime libertarians. And Ted Galen Carpenter, who was the single best guy at Cato, got fired for being good on Ukraine. And you may have seen a letter that was written to Cato by a group of libertarian institutions. And the signatures and the name of the institutions at the bottom of the letter was this long. And yet I never heard of any of these people. The Friedrich von Hayek Institute of Hungary and the Rothbard Institute of Poland and the Mises Institute of Lithuania and all of these things. Who are these people? Well, they all demand that America support Ukraine at war with Russia. And they all demanded that Ted Galen Carpenter be fired from the Cato Institute for opposing this policy. Now, Ted hasn't been perfect on everything. He's slipped a little bit on some of the war on terrorism stuff, but he has been absolutely fantastic on the Cold War in Eastern Europe, and of course is right up there with Ron Paul and Pat Buchanan and everyone who opposed NATO expansion in the very first place. He wrote a book against it in 1994 and has always been so good at explaining how American NATO expansion in Eastern Europe would end up causing problems for the United States and end up provoking a terrible reaction from the Russians. And then what did Cato do? instead of standing by their best guy who they employed for generations there, they fired him for being too good on American Intervention. But the silver lining is I hired him. So now he writes for the Libertarian Institute and for antiwar.com. And now I actually have even worse news, which is the Foundation for Economic Education, which has been, you know, they're not especially, you know, centered around foreign policy, but they've been essentially good on foreign policy with our movement this whole time. But they got a new boss over there, and he's at worst a hawk, at best a coward, and under pressure again from the Ukraine lobby, he actually deleted a bunch of articles from the FEE site opposing American intervention in the war and fired the guy who wrote them, a guy named Philip Carroll. He's also now going to be writing for us at the Institute. So this is a big deal. There is still a fight for the heart of libertarianism when, in fact, we already won this argument, and we won it big, because those of us who opposed Iraq War II and the rest of the Middle East wars, we were absolutely proven right. And all the, what we call them then, the liberventionists from 20, 25 years ago, they all had to shut the hell up. So the fact that they're trying to come back now and trying to make inroads into our movement now is a call to action for the rest of us, that we speak up and we make our point clear that no, in America's libertarian movement, regardless of whatever money gets passed around by USAID in Eastern Europe, around here, we're Ron Paul folk, and we're non-interventionists on foreign policy. There's no way we're going to let them get away with that. And that's all of us. And if you disagree with that, that's fine, but that just means you're not a libertarian. And Ukraine proves the point, as well as any of the Middle East disasters that we've witnessed over the past generation. And of course, Justin Raimondo and Dr. Ron Paul and all the rest of our great heroes were great on Ukraine the whole time. And of course, it should always be mentioned, when we talk about the greatness of Ron Paul, especially on foreign policy, we always have to stop and give credit to his right-hand man, the great Dan McAdams as well. And now, they were right. Of course they were right about NATO expansion. And they were right, of course, that it was the neoconservatives, our same old enemies, who led the way on American expansion in Eastern Europe the same way that they led the charge for wars for Israel in the Middle East. And how do I know? Well, I wrote a book about it. It's called Provoked: How Washington Started the New Cold War with Russia and the Catastrophe in Ukraine. Don't be intimidated by the length. It's about a quarter footnotes. So it's really only like reading three books in one instead of four. It's not that bad. John Mearsheimer and Ron Paul thought it was good. So there you go. And we got some for sale downstairs. And now, because of time constraints, I won't be able to tell the whole story as thoroughly as I sometimes like to do. But then again, I think, you know, probably most of y'all know a lot of this story anyway. But the bottom line, well, not the bottom line, I can fill some in. What happened essentially was at the end of the last Cold War, the Americans, beginning with H.W. Bush, before Bill Clinton ever came to town, they started spinning the Soviets. And George H.W. Bush told Mikhail Gorbachev at the end of 1989 in Malta that if you let the Eastern European Warsaw Pact states go free, we will not take advantage of that process. And that was it right there. And he knew what that meant, and so did everybody else. And I have that from the second to last ambassador to the USSR, Jack Matlock himself, explained. Everybody knew what that meant. Gorbachev knew what that meant. And H.W. Bush knew what that meant when he said it. And he meant what he said when he said it. We're not going to take advantage if you'll let Eastern Europe go. And then in the beginning of 1990, famously, James Baker issued the famous promise that America promises not to expand NATO one inch to the east if the Soviets would allow the reunification of Germany. Now, people say that this has been debunked. Well, I have rebunked it. They are wrong. They promised this over and over again. It was not just one promise by James Baker in one meeting on February 9th. It was numerous promises by James Baker, by Robert Gates, who was then the Deputy National Security Advisor, consulting with the head of the KGB, and as well as numerous statements by Margaret Thatcher and her successor, John Major, the Prime Ministers of Great Britain, by Douglas Hurd, their foreign minister, by Chancellor of Germany, Helmut Kohl, and his foreign minister, Hans-Dietrich Genscher, over and over and over and over again. They promised the Soviets, we will not move further east. Now, the wrinkle in this is that Baker's original promise was kind of confusing. He said, if you'll allow German reunification, then we won't bring East Germany into NATO. Well, but that doesn't make sense. If it's going to be reunified, and obviously under the West German regime, then obviously East Germany will also get that NATO war guarantee, right? So then they adapted it a little bit, but still respecting the spirit of the promise. And they said, well, what we'll do is we'll have a special military zone where we promise not to move Western troops or nuclear weapons into the former GDR, the former East Germany. And so that was what ended up in the treaty. And now if you ask James Baker now, or if you ask the New York Times now, they go, well, that's not in the treaty that we promised not to bring Poland into NATO. Well, that's correct. It's not in the treaty, but no one ever said it was in the treaty. Everybody explained that these were the promises that all these decisions were based on to allow reunification in the first place. And the Americans clearly were recognizing that and were respecting the spirit of the promise by promising not to move equipment into the east of Germany. Now, if the deal always was that, of course, they can bring Poland and Hungary and the Baltics into NATO and put military equipment there, then what difference would it make if they had military equipment in East Germany or not? And they knew that this was the deal that they had made, and they were, in essence, trying to respect it. And even when they changed their mind and broke the deal, and they created a new deal, they agreed a Founding Act of 1997 under Bill Clinton, they promise, okay, well, we are going to start bringing Eastern European countries into NATO, but we promise not to move any military equipment into them. And so again, sort of conceding that they're breaking the promise, but still trying to half respect it. And see, part of it too was that they had promised the Soviets that actually it doesn't even matter. There is no NATO expansion. That's kind of irrelevant because what we're going to do is we're going to make NATO a political organization. Think of like the EU plus America. And we're going to replace it as an alliance with a new security partnership. Because who needs an alliance? We don't have any enemies anymore. So what we're going to do is we're going to bring Russia and all of the Eastern European states who are already members of the Conference for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the CSCE, now known as the OSCE. We're going to make that the security partnership for Europe. And that will be the forum in which we solve Europe's problems nonviolently. And see, that way, Ukraine and Baltic and Belarusian and everybody's independence is baked in. Russia and they are all brought in together at the same time. But the thing is, they were lying. And they knew that they were lying. From the H.W. Bush government and through Bill Clinton, the plan was always to keep selling the Russians that this is what we're going to do, while what we're really doing is preparing Eastern European countries for NATO expansion. In the Bill Clinton years, they replaced the CSCE with a new regime called the Partnership for Peace, but again pushed the same lie, that we're doing this instead of NATO, and Russia and Ukraine and the rest of the Eastern European countries will all be brought in all at the same time. So everybody's neutrality is baked in, and there's nothing for any of these countries to be jealous about or fight about. But it was all a scam. And they knew they were lying. And from the time of Bush Sr., and then when Bill Clinton came in, he ended up pushing the same agenda while calling it something else. Now, I'll skip the shock therapy, other than to say that, as people in this room might guess, it was not a case of too much free market capitalism too soon, as in the conventional wisdom. It was a case of not enough free market capitalism too soon. Because you know what? They didn't send the Austrians from Auburn, Alabama, and they didn't even send the Chicago School. They sent the Harvard boys, the neoliberals, right, who don't really understand or appreciate capitalist theory or why freedom works at all. right? So they were exporting what Bill Clinton called free markets and democracy circa mid-1990s is what they were exporting to Russia. And so what that meant was there's still a huge amount of cronyism built into the economy. They still had a communist from the ancient regime in charge of the central bank who wouldn't stop printing money. And instead of insisting on a strict regime of property rights and of contracts and the very basic building blocks of a capitalist society, instead they went around picking winners and losers and saying, we want to connect with this guy and this guy and this guy, whoever speaks English best, who's ever willing to suck up to the Americans the most. They all get chosen to get the voucher schemes and all of the different methods that they had for quote unquote privatizing the Soviet economy, where they ended up, and very much with the help of the Americans, and the Russians are responsible for their own behavior, of course. The Americans and USAID was at the center of this. They absolutely bear responsibility. They took credit for it at the time, that they were the ones who reformed the Russian economy, and they ended up turning the whole country over to seven gangsters, not even businessmen, but just straight up throat-slitting murderers were the ones who took over the country. So imagine a literal communist economy, the Soviet Union, where the national government literally owned everything, all of the industries, all the businesses, everything. And imagine them transforming from that to capitalism, and 4 to 6 million excess deaths are caused over the course of about a decade. Now, obviously, they had a severe transition to accomplish somehow, but the Americans helped them absolutely ruin that transition to capitalism, and this really helped to engender a lot of resentment against the United States and a lot of support for the nationalist right in the country and support for the rise of Putin as a strong man in order to make things right again, essentially to reassert Russian independence. And of course, the rub there is Putin was a made guy. He was part of the Yeltsin family. That was what they called it, right? Just like a crime family in New York. He was part of the regime and he was promoted because he was helping guys get away with their crimes and get out of the country safely with their money. But then once he became the president, he asserted all this authority and sovereignty and moved to declare independence from the United States, which really helped to cause a lot of problems, of course. Also, very briefly, Bill Clinton, to a degree far greater than I had previously understood, supported Al-Qaeda in Bosnia, Chechnya, and Kosovo in the 1990s. And this was a big part, I think, of what caused the September 11th attack is, for example, when the FBI agents in Minneapolis wanted to search Zacharias Moussaoui's belongings because he wanted to know how to fly a jumbo jet, but he wasn't interested in how to take off or land. And they went, wait a minute, and they started looking at him. The FBI supervisors back in New York would not give them a FISA warrant to search his belongings, even though they had direct evidence from the French of his and his brother's direct ties to the bin Ladenites in Chechnya. Why? We like the bin Ladenites in Chechnya. They're not terrorists. They're nationalist freedom fighters. And so your request for a FISA warrant is denied. After September 11th, the night of September 11th, they finally searched his papers, and they would have been able to trace him directly back to the hijackers in Florida if they'd been allowed to do their job. There's a FBI agent named Michael Maltby whose fault September 11th is there. So that's a huge part of it. Then George W. Bush comes in, he tears up the anti-ballistic missile treaty, which also has the effect of killing the START II treaty, which the Russians had just ratified. And the START II treaty banned all multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles on nuclear missiles between both countries. So this decision by W. Bush and Putin's retaliation for tearing up START might be the two worst decisions that any human man ever made in the history of the world. I guess we'll find out, but we'll only know the truth for a couple of seconds before we're turned to ash. And then tearing up that treaty, the purpose was to put these anti-ballistic missile sites in Romania and Poland and the radars in the Czech Republic. And the thing is that it looks like maybe America's trying to achieve a first strike capability and cancel mutually assured destruction, which is, of course, the highest alarm inside Russia. But George W. Bush said, Vlad, that's crazy. We don't have enough missile interceptors here to shoot down an incoming salvo into Europe from Russia, so that can't be it. And Putin said, you know, that's a good point. Maybe it's that the MK-41 missile launcher is a dual-use missile launcher that can hold Tomahawk cruise missiles that can be tipped with hydrogen bombs. And maybe that's why you're putting these launchers in Romania and Poland. W. Bush said, no, it's to protect Poland from nuclear attack from Iran. except that Iran doesn't have nukes and they don't have missiles that can reach Poland, and Iran doesn't have any beef with Poland, and what? Nobody believed that. Maybe it's the dual-use Mark 41 missile launchers that can hold Sparrow interceptors, but they can also hold Tomahawk cruise missiles that can be tipped with H-bombs. And then Putin said, well, what do you expect me to do? I can either try to build a bunch of defensive sites, extremely sophisticated, extremely expensive anti-ballistic missile systems like you, or I could just build more offensive missiles. Guess what he chose? To build more offensive missiles. And he debuted them in 2018, and he explained they have an entire new generation of heavy missiles that can go around the South Pole and deliver as many as 24 warheads from a single rocket, enough to kill all of Texas with one rocket over the South Pole where we have no defense whatsoever, and with a lot more to boot as a direct consequence of W. Bush's brinksmanship there. And Bush also picked up where Bill Clinton left off with the color-coded revolutions. Now, some of you guys may know a little bit about this. Essentially, these are coups d'etat dressed up as popular revolutions. And usually what they do is they dispute an election. They say, well, our exit pollsters say that our guy should have won, not your guy. And this is the kind of foreign intervention in other people's elections that would drive Americans straight to war if anybody tried it here. Think about how crazy Americans went over the lies about Russian intervention in America in 2016. Imagine what they would have done if the Russians or the Chinese or anyone else exerted the kind of pressure that the United States does, pouring hundreds of millions of dollars in many cases into countries like Georgia, Ukraine, Kyrgyzstan, and other places in order to force these regime changes. And Bill Clinton got it started in the Balkans, and W. Bush pushed it through. Bill Clinton did Serbia in 2000. It was the biggest one. But then W. Bush comes in. He does the Rose Revolution in Georgia in 03. The Orange Revolution in Ukraine in 04, the Tulip Revolution in Kyrgyzstan in 05, and then also the failed Denim Revolution in Belarus in 2005. That was the second time they tried to overthrow Belarus. They did it again in 2020. And so this was huge. And then, of course, W. Bush promised to bring Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. And this was a huge mistake. And many of you may be familiar with what's now called the Nyet Means Nyet Memo. It was by a guy who was Biden's head of the CIA, William Burns. Hey, Phil, good to see you, man. And the memo is to Condoleezza Rice, and he was the ambassador to Russia at the time. And he's saying, madam, don't do this. He says he's talked to every expert in Moscow, from the most enlightened liberals, he says, to the most barbarian knuckle draggers in the darkest recesses of the Kremlin, and everybody at the think tanks, and everybody in the legislature, and everybody in between, and everybody is agreed. Ukraine especially, Georgia too, but Ukraine especially is the brightest of red lines for Russia. They are begging us not to do this. And this is Burns' words, paraphrasing Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, that if America goes to bring Ukraine into NATO, that could cause a civil war in Ukraine. And then that could cause Russia to have to face the choice of whether or not to intervene, a decision they do not want to have to make, right? So this is Lavrov at his most diplomatic, begging the United States, don't put us in this position. And Burns wrote in his memoir that he was sure that Condoleezza Rice agreed with him and the Secretary of State. And we know that the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, did, because he slammed Bush in his second memoir for this and insulted him, ridiculed him for this. Now, we don't know what they told Bush, but that was their positions. We also know that the entire National Security Council was against it. You remember Fiona Hill with the line for mouth that testified against Trump in the Ukraine gate thing. She was the Russia expert on the head of the Russia desk on the National Security Council. Well, she and Thomas Graham, who was more of a dove and was the chief of the Ukraine desk, they were against it. And they said that they polled the intelligence community. They didn't do an NIE, but they polled the CIA and everybody else, and they all recommended against an offer of Ukraine to join NATO. The president of France and the chancellor of Germany both also completely freaked out and did everything they could to stop it. Why? Because it costs too much money? That can't be it. It was because it's an unnecessary provocation against the Russians. That's it. That was the single one and only reason that all of the experts said that we should not do this. And then why did W. Bush do it anyway? Well, as Burns wrote in his memoir, it was legacy building for George W. Bush. See, his legacy was supposed to be remaking Iraq. Well, that didn't turn out that well. He was going to go down in history, and they should have not said this until he was gone. But they were already announcing that he was going to be ranked among the worst presidents in all of American history. He wanted to seize all the Social Security IOUs and put them in the stock market bubble, the same one that crashed at the end of 08 before he was even out of the office. Remember? They wouldn't let him do that. So what was his legacy? Nothing but failure. So he had to do something big, and this was something big. And so that was what it was. And he went ahead at Bucharest, and even though the Germans would not let him give a real offer, he essentially announced a sort of half offer to Ukraine and Georgia that you guys are on the path now to eventual NATO membership. And that resulted in a war breaking out in Georgia, which the American puppet Saakashvili started because he was trying to solve his border dispute with two breakaway provinces before this offer would come due. You can't have an ongoing border dispute and join NATO. So he was trying to take back these two provinces and launched a war, which completely backfired and led to the Russians invading and taking back those two provinces and threatening even the capital of Georgia, which they did not take and could have. So this is a absolute, one of W. Bush's worst blunders, if you can believe it. I know it's a long list. Obama comes in. How much time? Oh, man. Obama comes in. You guys know how I do. The worst thing that Obama did, and there was a bunch of them, was he overthrew the government of Ukraine again in the Maidan Revolution of 2014. And this resulted immediately in the loss of Crimea and then the outbreak of war in the East. And the outbreak of war in the East really happened, I think, because the new regime in Kiev and the Obama government were overreacting after the loss of Crimea. And they were afraid that they were going to completely lose the entire eastern part of Ukraine as well. And so they went to war. But then when they did, about half the army split and went to the other side, guaranteeing that it would be a real war between mechanized forces. And then they brought in all the Nazi militias who had helped to accomplish the street putsch to overthrow the government in February of 2014, and they founded a group called the Azov Battalion to be the leading edge of the counterinsurgency until the army could get their act together to launch the war. And it was a horrific war. About 9,000 people were killed in the first year until they signed a couple of peace agreements, Minsk I and Minsk II, that were supposed to bring an end to the war. And they did bring an end to the airstrikes and the heavy artillery and the tank war. There's still some artillery going back and forth, and about another 4,000 people were killed, mostly combatants, but some civilians, over the next 7 years as the issue remained unresolved and as the Obama government and then the Trump government would not intervene with the Ukrainians to make sure that they implemented this peace deal. And this was a deal that was worked out by our German and French allies, but then was rubber stamped by Obama and the UN Security Council. So this was absolutely supposed to be the deal, but America would never put pressure on the Ukrainians to implement their side of it. And then he poured, and we also know from later reporting that the CIA launched the war, essentially that John Brennan came to town on April the 12th, and on the 14th, they attacked. And that the CIA, according to the New York Times, built 14 secret bases inside Ukraine, including right up along the Ukrainian-Russian border, and ran the war the whole time. They lied about that at the time, but they admit that truth now. Now, of course, when Trump came in, he was falsely accused of being a Russian agent. I have 75 pages in the book on Russiagate where I explain the lie behind each and every one of those claims that they made against him, as best I could. I may have forgot a couple, but I think I got it all for you. And the whole thing absolutely was a hoax perpetrated by the CIA, the FBI, and the Democratic Party and the Clinton campaign against Donald Trump. And they kept the thing going for the first 2 years of his presidency and change. And the FBI told CNN, well, if we can't overthrow him with the 25th Amendment, you know, like they should have done to Joe Biden for being senile, then at least we can use the special counsel investigation to rein him in. This is the FBI saying, yes, we're going to pretend to investigate the president of the United States so we can rein him in and prevent him from having an independent Russia policy, prevent him from making peace with Russia. And that was their big objection, and they pushed it, and it worked. And because, and you guys probably remember when Trump bombed Syria, his son said, now call us Russian agents. If we're Russian agents, how come we're bombing Russia's guy Assad? And Trump said, oh yeah, if I'm a Russian agent, how come I'm working so hard to prevent the completion of the Nord Stream pipeline? If I'm such a Russian agent, how come I'm pouring in all these weapons to Ukraine that Obama was afraid to? And actually, Obama did send in a bunch of weapons, but they lie about that. And even recently, Trump brings these things up. I was way tougher on Russia even than Obama was, he said. This was him protecting himself, right? Covering his own right flank from all these attacks of being a traitor. When what he should have done was just invited Putin to Washington and sign a bunch of new nuclear treaties and shove the whole scandal right down their throats. He could have just fired everyone at Justice and then declassified all the data, shipped it to the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and then moved on with his day, since there was nothing there for them to use against him anyway. It was all a lie. But they absolutely hemmed him in. And I don't even know if Trump knows this or not, but his ambassador, William Taylor, prevented another peace deal. When the German foreign minister, Steinmeier, came up with a way to resolve the conflict, the ambassador, William Taylor, told the new president, Zelensky, don't sign this. It's a bad deal. Don't do it. Don't implement it. And the Nazis were threatening to murder him, and the Americans were not willing to protect him from the Nazis. And so he was in a position, even though he was elected on peace, to put that on the back burner and to continue following orders. There was too much at stake. And now that I'm almost out of time, it's time to get to the war. When Joe Biden came in, the policy clearly was, well, first of all, I think the last straw for Putin was when the Zelensky regime cracked down on the last Russia-friendly oligarch in Ukraine, a guy named Medvedchuk, seized his media properties and the rest and put him on house arrest. And this is his daughter is Putin's goddaughter. So this was, I think, the last straw for the Russians. And they started building up their forces on the border in the spring of 21. And from that time, clearly, the decision was made in the Biden government that we are going to threaten the Russians that you better not do it. But we're not going to negotiate in good faith with them to try to prevent the war. And the two major issues, of course, outstanding were the ongoing war in the Donbass, the civil war, and further NATO encroachment into Eastern Europe and further integration, the including of Ukraine as a de facto member of the NATO alliance under what they call interoperability. And this is where the American military comes in and remakes a local military as they're joining NATO or before they join NATO, completely, you know, set up their command and control systems, all their communication, and begin with the conversion from whatever their legacy weapon systems were to American weapon systems. And this meant that in effect, as Mearsheimer and Walt said for years, that America was making Ukraine a de facto member of NATO. So in other words, if the Russian Federation and NATO went to war, the Ukrainian military would be just another auxiliary army, just like the Germans and the Hungarians and the Lithuanians and everyone else under supreme allied NATO command. Whether they got a war guarantee from us was sort of beside the point. They would still be part of our coalition if we went to war. And so the Russians were making it clear, listen, we want a new treaty, and we want you to promise not to bring Ukraine into NATO, and we want to end to the war in the East. And the Biden government, again, would say, you better not do it, but refuse to negotiate with them in good faith on any of the important issues. And they would promise to. And here's the thing about it, guys, as I think y'all know, America never had any real intention of bringing Ukraine into NATO, as Biden put it, at least not anytime soon, not anytime in the next 10 years even. They're way too corrupt of an economy and a political system, and it would cause so many problems. Our allies are not with it. There's so many reasons we can't do it. But what do they say? They said, we have an open door policy. Now, there is no door, right? It's just jargon. What does it mean? It means any country can join NATO if they want to and we want them to, and no third country has a say in it. And no third country security concerns are to be taken into account as a reason why not to. As the way they put it in committee, well, does anyone here think that we should just give the Russians veto power over who we allow into our alliance? No one raises their hand. Okay, well, there it is then. We have an open door and no one can say anything about it. And so that means even if the Russians are telling us in the clearest language, this is going to lead to war and we absolutely not will not put up with it, as John Mearsheimer warned back in 2014, we try to bring Ukraine into NATO, Russia will simply invade and wreck it so that we can't have it. That's how important it is to them. It's inevitable that that is how this is going to take place. And so then, as we now, I think, all understand, this was the Biden administration's plan. They thought, well, we can warn them they better not. But you know what? If they invade, that's actually not a bad thing. Because what we can do is we can weaken Russia by supporting Ukraine at war. And at first, they assumed that the Ukrainian regime, that their military would be smashed and they would be supporting an Afghan-style insurgency. This is just months after America's final humiliating withdrawal from Afghanistan and defeat in Afghanistan. And they go, yeah, the 1980s Afghan war, that was great. That didn't lead to any consequences that we regret or anything. Let's try to do that again. And so that was their model. Let's essentially go ahead, as Brzezinski said about the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan then, well, we weren't deliberately trying to provoke it, but we were taking steps that we knew would increase the probability that they would. And then, as they said over and over again, we don't want to end the war with negotiations. We want to continue the war as long as possible to weaken Russia. They said it over and over again, and as I'm sure many of you have heard, so many American politicians, pundits, journalists, and opinion havers out there have said over and over again, this war is great for the United States of America because it's not costing us any lives. Russians are dying, but no American soldiers are dying. It's just great. We've never got this much bang for our buck. And in many cases, they don't even mention the Ukrainians at all. In fact, David Ignatius put them in parentheses. Boy, this has been great. We got two new members of NATO. Sweden and Finland have joined. We've got European nations boosting their spending on militarism across the board. Everybody's now like reinvigorated in the NATO alliance. It's wonderful. This war's been great for everyone, except for the Ukrainians, he says in parentheses. Ignatius is the CIA spokesman at the Washington Post, if you're not familiar. Very important guy. And that's the consensus, is that essentially Ukrainians don't count in this. They're extras in our movie, and this is all a method of weakening Russia. But of course, it hasn't worked. The Russians simply turned east, and they've saved their economy by just trading out who their trading partners are. Instead of Europe, now they're trading with Asia instead. Russia is the entire northern part of Asia, you know, so they kind of have direct access. They have natural gas and oil pipelines to China. They don't need us. America said, you're kicked out of Russia. They said, out of Europe. They said, fine. And they're doing fine without us. And the bad news is that even though I believe that Donald Trump absolutely was sincere in running on wanting to end this war, I think he's sincere in wanting to end the war right now. I don't think he can. They're supposed to be meeting in Istanbul, Turkey right now to kickstart this thing. But the problem is Donald Trump was inaugurated for the beginning of his second term at just a bad time. The Russians are ascendant on the battlefield. They're winning. The Ukrainians are losing. That's the Western side, leaving Trump essentially no cards to play. He can try to send in more sophisticated missile systems. Biden already tried that. He can try to add new sanctions on Russia. Biden already tried that. So he has no sticks, only carrots. And he's got a pretty good carrot, which is, hey, Russia, how about we drop all the sanctions and normalize relations and become friends again? That's a big one. And, you know, if you're the praying type, I suggest you ask Jesus for help in getting Putin to see the light and take up that deal. But look at the situation on the ground. The Russians are far short of their goal. They've claimed to have annexed 4 provinces, but they only control one of them, and they control only portions of the other 3. And they have the formerly Russian cities of Kharkiv and Odessa in sight. And there's a lot of pressure in Russian politics that says we've come this far now. There's no reason to quit. We got to keep going until we win. Got to take everything east of the river. And then, geez, you're going to really leave Odessa, the gem of the Black Sea and Ukraine's most important port? When we could take it back, it would be ours, and we could deprive them of it. And so they have a lot of incentive to just keep fighting until they've won on their terms. And the Western side essentially has so few cards to play that I'm very pessimistic that Trump will be able to see this deal through. Hopefully his carrots that he has to offer of improved relations between Russia and the United States is a good one. But then again, if you were Vladimir Putin, could you trust that? I mean, the Democrats could win in 3.5 years and then we'd be right back where we were again. And so it's going to be very difficult to see that all the way through. And I hate to leave on that pessimistic note, but I think that that's where we are now. I guess I would just add in closing here that when I debated Wesley Clark on the Piers Morgan show, And I said, look, but Ukraine can't win. He finally conceded and said, yeah, but we shouldn't be talking like that because that gives the Russians, you know, the feeling that they are in a position of an advantageous position. But they know exactly where their forces are on the ground in Ukraine. They don't need to learn that from me. That doesn't change really anything there. Other than him admitting that I'm right and that he's wrong, that the war can end on any terms favorable to the United States. And then lastly, I would just point out that the worst power couple in the Washington War Party, Robert Kagan and his wife, Victoria Nuland, have both admitted that none of this is necessary at all. Robert Kagan said, you know what, now that we think about it, it doesn't matter to the United States of America who rules Ukraine. The northern coast of the Black Sea has never been an interest of ours. And he says, geez, if you think about it now, during the old Cold War, the Soviet Union, Moscow dominated all of Ukraine that whole time and it never bothered us at all. He says, we think of that now as the good old days. Well, forget that. It was not the good old days. It was totalitarian slavery for hundreds of millions of people. But anyway, the part about it doesn't matter who rules Ukraine was right. And then his wife, Victoria Nuland, in her exit interview, scoffed at Russia and said, boy, all this talk that if we don't stop Russia in the Donbass, they're going to be marching into Warsaw and Berlin. Pff, what a joke that is, huh? What a paper tiger Russia's military turned out to be after all, huh? Sure, they have the capability to hold on to eastern Ukraine. There's no way that the Ukrainians can roll back any Russian gains that they've made in the country, sure. No question there. But do they have the ability to take on Poland and the Baltics and Germany and France and Britain? Come on. Even Victoria Nuland says that's a hoax. It's a ridiculous hoax. You don't have to believe that there's any threat from Russia to Western Europe because there is not one. And if that's good enough for them, and that fits right into my confirmation bias, I think that that's perfectly right, and that ought to be good enough for the rest of us too. Thank you.